Continuing with Brian Cooper on 6 March 78. So then, after this project was over, this is the first time you directly became involved in radio astronomy, I believe?
Yes.
How did that come about?
Well, I remember Chris and Wilbur Christensen coming to talk to me, possibly early in 1958, saying, in our radio astronomy operations, we've been operating pretty much ad hoc, various individuals building their own receivers as they see the need.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's about time we had a receiver group as such to do this on a formal basis. And, would I like to have a go at it? So I said, oh, it sounds interesting. I'll have a go. And it then seemed to me that it would be a good idea to go overseas and see what we're doing in the States in particular. So I established contact with the solid state maser had just burst into the headlines, and that was obviously going to be a winner as far as microwave radio astronomy was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And Bloomberg at Harvard was one of the leaders in maser techniques, and he was ready to get together with Tom Gold in the Harvard College Observatory, and I got in touch with them, and they organized a year fellowship for me to
mm-hmm.
go and join their group.
And what year was that precisely?
I went over late 58.
And what did you find when you got to Harvard? Had they already developed a maser, or?
It was pretty much a laboratory type operation. Of course, Bloomberg was running the division of. He wasn't running it. It was Will and Bob was the actual chief dean of the faculty. He was organizing that particular line of solid-state physics in cryogenic techniques, including masers and spin resonance.
Mm-hmm.
They call it spin resonance.
NMR techniques.
NMR also, right. Yes. The way it was organized was that Tom Gold got the funding from, I think it was ONR in particular,
mm-hmm.
To put a solid state maser on the 60-foot Agassiz dish,
right.
But using the know-how of the physics department.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, Towns had built a 3-centimeter maser. It was a very nice operation that to build that so quickly and get it onto the NRL dish.
Right. Did you ever see that maser or visit the dish?
By the time I got down there, it was very much a laboratory operation, a demonstration of the capability or possibilities of the technique. I don't think they left on the dish for very long.
No, I don't think so. Yeah. So you never actually saw that in operation?
I never saw it in operation, but I just saw it back in the laboratory. And it's Conning Mayer.
Right. Mm. So, but the Harvard maser was at 21 centimeters, I believe.
Yes. Yes, well, that was an obvious, fruitful field for a maser because of the the Dutch people are just showing the potentialities of extragalactic H-line work.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Okay.
I was just going to say, at that point, can you just tell me what you saw as the great advantages of the maser and as well as the disadvantages over other receivers?
Well, it looked like being the, at that stage it was obviously going to be the lowest noise receiver, pending, excluding some dramatic developments in Paramps.
Right.
The Paramp was resurrected about the same time. You may have probably heard the, a lot of the history of the Mesa and the Paramp, but...
No, I haven't heard that much. I'm not sure what you mean by resurrected.
Well, the Paramp was a known technique. You know, it had its roots going back ages into electronic history.
Well, what do you mean by ages? Can you be a little more precise?
When the Mesa emerged, I guess it made a lot of people who had in the back of their head the knowledge of variable reactance amplification, and they suddenly realized that an amplifier with a pure variable reactance shouldn't have any noise in it. And I guess at the same time they realized with the advances in semiconductor diodes that uses variable capacitances that they ought to make fairly low noise amplifiers. And I suppose the Stanford group would have been the first one to exploit this to a practical stage.
In radio astronomy?
I guess they started to talk to Ron Bracewell too, and see what possible interest there could be to radio astronomy.
But what do you mean by the Stanford group? Which people do you mean?
Let me think.
Or which department?
He's moved out of solid state work. His name just escaped me.
Was it the physics department?
Yeah, it was really the electrical engineering department at Stanford.
I can check.
It didn't take them long to demonstrate that a variable reactance amplifier could be built with pretty low noise capabilities.
And so this got a lot of interest going in Paramps.
Mm.
But now, still, I'm interested in the resurrected phase. I mean, for instance, during the war, was this technique known and never used, or what are you referring to?
I'd have to look at some of the early papers on Paramps. To get where the origins of the basic technique, where the roots came from. Perhaps I could come back to you on that one.
Well, but still, just give me some idea. Was it? I mean, you're talking about early 50s, 40s, 30s, 20s?
It's like all these things. You probably find that maybe even Lord Rayleigh might have had something to say about it.
I mean, as far as the building of something that you might call a paramp.
It may be that if you can, people knew that devices involving nonlinear reactances could oscillate under some conditions, and that's just one manifestation of amplification.
But they never built it.
No.
So you're really talking that the idea was resurrected
and
brought into fruition as a useful technique.
Yes, that's right. Mm. And I remember as soon as some of these early reactor amplifiers were built up, wondering from the Australian viewpoint whether I was in the right game because of the difficulties of operating masers. The idea was to as far as radio physics was concerned, was to get the best trade-off between performance and practical usability for the 64 meter dish.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the die was set as far as Harvey was concerned. And,
why did you wonder if you were in the
right? Well, I was thinking of the mazes of that time required heavy magnets, logistics of moving helium around, the cost of helium if you either had the option of recycling it or letting it go.
It was an expensive technology.
Expensive technology, yeah, yes.
But now, going back to my question about what did you see, is the advantage of the maser was its low noise operation. Were there other, I think that's really the
yes.
only advantage.
Yes.
What were the disadvantages?
Well, the disadvantages were the narrow bandwidth. The first masers were based on the regenerative type operation in a cavity. Fortunately, the circulator had just emerged as a practical device that made a cavity maser a practically operable device. But it wasn't long before DeGrasse at Bell Labs showed that a traveling wave maser was possible. There again, the Stanford group were very active. There was a guy called Seidman who was working at Stanford, but he didn't have the resources that Bell had. He demonstrated another type of traveling wave maser in the laboratory.
This was about what time?
About the 59, I think, to 60 then.
Mm-hmm. So the narrow band was a disadvantage.
Yes.
And what else?
You needed very good circulators to make the device stable. But I guess that went for the parent too.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying that the parent wasn't particularly more stable than the maser in those days?
No, not really. No.
That situation changed later on, though, I would say.
Yes, I guess it's never been a clear-cut situation. Always been a neck-and-neck
yes.
situation. But of course, these days, the traveling wave maser, within its bandwidth capabilities, is such a beautiful device. Especially the ones built by NASA.
Yeah.
But of course, we're, apart from the spectral line work, we've always had this emphasis on broad, maximum possible bandwidth for continual operations. And it was clear that the reactor, the parent, could outdistance the maser, as far ahead as one could see.
Right.
So if your interest were in continual operations, you certainly would have a bias towards parents.
But the maser was nice for line operations,
yes.
like it was planned at Harvard.
Mm. Yes.
And so this maser got going, I guess, and actually got put on the dish.
Yes.
Were there any surprises in how it behaved?
It was a little, being an experimental device, it had its shortcomings for a start, unstable, but when we gradually realized the nature of the instabilities and got around them one way or another.
Was helium cooled?
It was the open cycle liquid helium cooled. We used to get the 25 litre dewars of liquid helium shipped out from MIT.
Uh-huh.
Had a good deal with MIT. They supplied at a very nominal rate, something like $5 a litre, which was quite cheap in those days.
And what sort of system temperature did it?
It it was 100 kelvins, which is always distressing to me, considering there was a Mazer down there with an intrinsic noise temperature of perhaps 10 kelvins or less.
But the technology of the other components hadn't come along then.
That's right. Well, if you spent another year whittling down the losses, you might have got it down to 50 kelvins.
But that 100 was still far superior to anything that had been achieved. What was the...
even considering the small dish, it did a lot of useful external galaxy work.
What was the second best system temperature at 21 centimeters, would you say? Was that probably the Anduigolo or something like that?
Yes, they were operating with... they had Muller, who was a very good man on receiver technology, mm-hmm. and I guess he was getting his crystal mixer receivers. I suppose his crystal mixer receivers were rated on single sideband operations, which is what you use for spectral line work, would still have been around 800-900 kelvins.
So this is a vast improvement.
He had that double the collecting area, which helped him. For a long time, the Dwindler operations led the world, which had this 25 meter dish and pretty good and stable receivers.
Right. Well, more generally, when you were visiting the Harvard Astronomy Group, what impressions did you have of what they were doing? Did it seem like they were getting a lot of good things done, or they had good direction, or what would you say?
Well, they were mainly operating with... a lot of the emphasis was on graduate training, I'm getting a little hazy now on who were the leaders in the States on radio astronomy. there was a lot of people were moving around a lot, and I guess any one place didn't retain a good man in some particular field of radio astronomy for any length of time. Because NRAO was trying to build up its staff.
NRL was pretty much the same people through the years.
Yes, that's right. Yes, NRL was a stable group.
Good civil service group.
Yes, yes.
But what
I worked with Sam Goldstein. I was just going to mention Eugene Epstein. I remember him doing his PhD work on Harvard Mazer.
But I was just trying to get your impressions of this American radio astronomy effort as opposed to the Australian one that you were much more familiar with. Yes. Differences in style or whatever.
Yes. I don't pretend to be a good judge of radio astronomy as such, but it was obvious that the close-knit Australian groups, they started off with a head lead here, getting some good physicists and with no other preoccupations, and the Dutch group was very strong. And the Cambridge and Jodrell groups, people looked up to them in those days, I think. I suppose, too, the American groups, in particular the Harvard group, were still struggling to get out from under the stigma of some of the furfies, some of the... detections that turned out to be non-detections.
I've never heard that term furfy before. That's a screw up?
It was an Irish term. Yeah. It's a rumor, actually.
A rumor, right?
Yes. Yes.
Well, that's true. They did have some of these furfies, as you say.
Yeah, furfies probably not quite the right word. Ill-founded detections, yes.
Right. Mm. And what do you think those came about simply because of
lack of experience, I suppose, and tendency to place a blind faith in statistics.
That, right.
You know, this observation was done for a certain length of time. The two signal was so and so.
Therefore,
there's a bump on the record.
It must be
there.
Real.
Yes.
Mm. So really, not understanding instrumental effects.
Yes.
No, I think that's a fair assessment. And I've always been struck by the fact that the Harvard group, although it produced many good people that later on mm-hmm. became leaders in American radio astronomy, didn't really produce much good science itself in the period of the late 50s. They had some of these mistakes, and in addition, what they did do was sort of uninteresting, you know, maps of this little part or that little part of the sky.
Yes. Yes, Dave Heeshan, he was one of them, wasn't he?
Right.
At that early stage. I don't recall really what Dave was doing.
Well, it was just another one of these, if I remember correctly, a map of a certain part of the sky, you know, that probably Bach said to look at, but they never, if you look at the history of the subject as a whole, these things did not contribute. Anywhere near, for instance, like the Dutch effort was contributing in HMS.
No, well, that was, they came over, and I remember one of the group, I've forgotten who, came over to HCO and gave a colloquium on the latest detection of hydrogen external galaxies, and then they had a big list of galaxies, and everyone at HCO was glued to their words, you know, God, that's wonderful stuff. But I guess Martin Bok deserved a bit more, really, having got that 60-foot dish into operation quite early in the piece. It could have been exploited.
Right, that's what I'm thinking. Perhaps it was the lack of a solid radio person as his right-hand man. Do you think that...
Yes, that may have been so. Yeah.
He certainly had the astronomical background, but...
Harold Ewan, that was a good operation of Harold Ewan's to get onto the hydrogen lines so early.
Right, that was the physics department.
Yes.
That was a single experiment.
But there again, I guess Harold Ewan was, saw the. You want to exploit the commercial advantages.
Right.
He was a good businessman. Really.
Right, well, and he sold them equipment and so forth, but but he wasn't there to, when someone had a two...
He just
wasn't
handed over.
Right. When someone had a three sigma bump, he wasn't there to say, well, look, be careful about that.
That's right, yes. Yes. Well, I guess one thing... the Sandy Weinreb originated in those days. I remember speaking occasionally to Sandy. He spent some time with Ewan Knight as an engineer.
Oh, really? I see. I haven't talked to him yet. I didn't realize that.
He's one of the guys I think is tremendous, Sandy Weinreb.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so you had this 1 year, and you learned, I guess, that masers were not for radio physics. Because they were just too bulky and too expensive.
Yes.
And
actually, we had quite some background in, or some people to talk to about masers, in that at that stage we were in the university grounds, in the same building as the Division of Physics at CSIRO, and they were doing paramagnetic physics, and Gib Vogel, the guy who died under those unfortunate circumstances, he was quite a bright boy in low temperature physics and paramagnetic resonance. supplied a lot of the physical know-how to, and some suggestions to radio physics, Frank Gardner. Actually, when I went over to the States, Frank Gardner, have you spoken to Frank yet?
Mm-hmm.
Did he mention his early experiments with a maser?
I forget. This was 3 or 4 years ago that I got him when he was in Bonn, so I can't quite remember now.
Yes. Well, they got to the stage of making getting a maser amplifying in the laboratory. This was using potassium chrome cyanide, which wasn't a particularly good paramagnetic crystal.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't long before everyone realized that ruby was the best material.
Right.
But, there again, Frank himself realized that, as far as we were concerned, that a Varactor amplifier would be the taking all things in consideration would be the best thing to start off with.
On the Parkes issue.
He and Doug Milne put together quite a reasonable paramp, which was the first, actually the first cooled receiver put on the Parkes dish.
Was that nitrogen cooled or?
No, liquid nitrogen cooled. You just pour the liquid nitrogen into it.
Right, and what wavelength was that?
This was for 21 centimeters too, but it was primarily aimed at continuum work. It was what we call a degenerate type paramp. Very difficult to separate out the signal band and the image band that gets folded over onto each other.
Right. So you came back and more or less being head of this receiver section had to decide what was going to be the stable of receivers that Parkes would have. Can you just tell me what you decided at that stage?
Well, after a lot of discussion within the group, we decided that for the time being, as far as we could see, we would put our efforts into paramps. And Frank had this liquid nitrogen cool amplifier ready for when the dish was commissioned. He started work on this possibly 1960, 51, and it was ready to go on the dish when it was commissioned. It really didn't get into operation. I think it was commissioned in 61, but it didn't get fully into operation until about March 62. And his cooled receiver was very good. If you've got the 1963 Proceedings of the Institute of Radio Engineers, you'd see some of his first observations, which were dig right down to the noise.
Mm-hmm. Mm. What other wavelengths did you think that you needed at that time?
We started a little bit later on a 10 centimeter or 11 centimeter receiver. That was paramp, but for various reasons we decided to run that one at room temperature. We wanted to get the broadest bandwidth, and we thought we'd minimize some of the problems by starting a broadband development work at room temperature.
I see. Mm. So those were the first two receivers really that were used on the dish?
Oh, well, there were several crystal mixer receivers. For instance, the hydrogen line receiver, along with its 48-channel filter back end, was transported from. It used to be used on a small dish
in Murraybank.
Right. That was moved over at the earliest opportunity to Parkes. And Brian Robinson, he'd gone over to Dwingalow.
Mm-hmm.
But you have
a history. Right.
Well, he started work on the paramp for the Dwingalow dish. The story is much the same there too. Perhaps you told you that they did some major experiments and then dropped them in favor of parent work. And
for the same reasons? I mean, of expense?
Yes, same general reasons.
And the trouble of all the plumbing.
And the thought that a parent would be almost as good in taking all practical factors into consideration.
Yeah.
And actually, he came back with the basic design that he'd evolved for the Dwindlo dish and finished off a param over here. And that was specifically designed for extragalactic observations. So we really had...
And that's where that...
They were the three first relatively low noise params put onto the Parkes dish. The Frank Gardner's Continuum param.
Right.
Brian Robinson's extragalactic H-line param and the 11 centimeter.
Well, the one that Brian Robinson's 21 centimeter was the one that produced another Furphy, though.
Yes, that's true.
Now that I think about it.
Yes.
Was it Keeler and Robinson? How do you pronounce that? Kohler? Keeler? So you can say absorption.
Yes. What was his
name? It's K-O-E-H-L-E-R.
Oh, Kohler. Kohler. Yeah, Jim Kohler. That's right. Yes, that's true. Yes.
But now, going back to your own work, I'd like to hear the story of the polarization in Centaurus A from your point of view.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about?
Well, I guess all of us who were working on the Parkes dish in those early days, whether we were basically on equipment or the others who were waiting to use equipment, were urged to help in the observations or originate observations, whichever were their particular inclinations. And John Bolton said to me, "Oh, how about having a look at Centaurus A? That'd be an interesting source to look at." And at that stage, I didn't know a great deal about Centaurus A, but I said, "Oh, okay." At the same time, I'd seen some of the observations of the galactic center, and I thought, "Oh, this ought to be a nice source to resolve." I guess there are a lot of informal observations in the first few months of operation of the dish, but by the first quarter of 62, there were properly scheduled observations were put out. I found that the other thing is that Ron Bracewell had come out, and he was particularly interested in Centaurus A because he'd been observing it with Stanford equipment, and so we said, "Well, why don't you join in with us, and we're going to do some 11 centimeter or 10 centimeter observations." There was a rudimentary crystal mixer receiver put on for the first few weeks of operation of the dish to check its performance at 10 centimeters. And that was, we said, "Well, we'll get together with you, Ron, and have a look at Centaurus A." So it happened, the right ascension of Centaurus A is 13 hours, and 13 hours, 23 minutes, and the galactic center is close to 18 hours.
Right.
And I found that I was scheduled to do some observations on Centaurus A in the early part of the night, and then carrying on to the galactic center in the second part of the night. This is how the clock works in March,
yeah.
I think it was. And I'm trying to recall all the circumstances.
Yeah, right. Right.
And Jim Roberts, too, was become interested in polarization work. And he'd had a feed rotator put on the dish. So that was available at the time. But, I personally didn't realize the significance of linear polarization in sources. And I guess the upshot of it all was that I said to Ron, well, you can start observing, do your scans of Centaurus A, and I'll turn up later in the night and take over and do the galactic center, which actually was had become of interest to Mark Price. He was a student from ANU at mm-hmm. that stage. So we were to take over and do the galactic center as the second half operation.
Right.
And I remember coming back after catching a bit of rest and having Ron say, gosh, this is interesting. I've just been changing the position angle of the feed and the intensity changes dramatically. I guess the other angle too was that one of our experimental officers, Tom Cousins, was responsible for the building the receiver and checking it out, making it work on the dish. So there's the question of his involvement in it too, but he wasn't particularly interested in any observations. He just went up to see that the equipment was working.
Well, he was a co-author with Bracewell
in
that Nature paper. Mm.
But, to reveal all the circumstances, there was a ticklish operation of authorship, and I really suppose in many ways Ron could claim to have been responsible for the observation. He realised the potential that, of possible polarisation. I don't know whether he knew that Connie Mayo was wondering whether Centaurus A was polarised. He'd been looking at it, and of course Centaurus was scraping the horizon as it went by in RL, and I believe he was wondering about publishing the result, but he wasn't sure because of the difficult observations.
Yeah.
Because he at that stage he had verified the polarisation Cygnus, I think, and Taurus. 3 centimeters.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what else? Cygnus and Taurus. Possibly. I don't know if there was another source of
them. I'm not sure either. But...
Anyway, there was some debate at that stage of who the observation should be credited to. As far as I was concerned, Ron could have been the principal author, but there was some debate about, it was a radio physics facility.
So that's how
so it became Bracewell, Cooper and Cousins. but I certainly don't want to belittle Ron's immediate realization of the fact that there was very high polarization in the central core. Yes.
But how did the solution of 2 different papers come about, rather than just 1 paper?
No, there weren't.
Yeah, there are 2 papers right next to each other. I'm sorry.
Oh, well,
one is by you and...
Oh, well, it wasn't long. As soon as we realized it was polarized, Mark Price was looking for a thesis project, and... I guess we said, well, if this is polarized, we should observe it at as many wavelengths as we can dredge up receivers for.
Right.
I guess the observations at a range of frequencies were done as soon as we could organize the time and the equipment.
That was Cooper and Price.
Yes. Mm. And there again, I'd like to give a lot of credit to Mark Price for realizing sooner than I did the possibility of the Faraday rotation.
Mm-hmm.
Because we improvised the receivers very quickly, and the rotation of the feed, possible spurious effects weren't checked out thoroughly. But when he was analysing the first observations at 21 centimetres, he said, you know, this polarisation angle is quite a bit different at 10 centimetres. It was a matter of at least 50 or 60 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a bit sceptical myself, you know, realising all the possibilities, the mental effects. But he said, you know, I've been reading up a bit about Faraday rotation, and it might be a really genuine effect. And he'd speak to Frank Kerr and others, and they think it ought to be checked out.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, well, we'll see what we can do about how far we can tune these receivers off without the performance collapsing completely. And in one night we twiddled all the oscillators we could find, and even though the receiver's performance was getting quite hairy and isn't tuned off a fair distance, there was still a very strong signal. And we realised that although the angle only changed, I've forgotten what the exact amount is, perhaps 50, 60 degrees, it's actually gone right around the other direction, not the rotation was in a certain direction to take it.
And how much change in wavelength did you achieve, or in frequency?
We got as far as 1,000 megahertz.
Different from
30 centimetres. We span in various jumps between 10 centimetres and 30 centimetres, with some big holes in between.
Mm-hmm.
But soon became obvious that it was a smooth lambda squared rotation.
And even you became convinced that it was real.
Mm. But I'd like to go on record saying I think Mark Price was the one who was onto that first.
Mm-hmm. Although the Bracewell et al. Paper came a couple months later in Nature, it really was the first observation.
That's right. There was some argument about it.
Well, I think I've heard that Taffy Bowen was wanted to make damn sure that your paper came out first, but I hadn't realized that.
These things get a bit hazy.
What do you think have been the key ingredients of the success of radiophysics and radio astronomy?
Well, I think it was retaining that core of top physicists, well, some of them are top anyway,
mm-hmm.
In the division fortuitously, and the fact that early radio astronomy could be, very good radio astronomy could be done in the first years on a shoestring.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the physicists actually did feel the urge to go overseas as soon as the war ended, but there was still a lot left to I guess there were recruits. John Bolton came over from England,
right,
of course, and Paul Wilde.
But you were saying in the radiation lab at MIT, yes, this did not happen.
No, I'm not clear exactly where they all went, but there was tremendous admiration for the radiation lab, how they said everything that needed to be said about microwave radar in that volume of books. It was all discovered in a matter of a few years,
and mm-hmm.
for a long time nothing new was said about microwaves.
But they all,
if that group had got onto radio astronomy, they would have possibly killed everyone else.
Mm-hmm. I guess the universities here are not so attractive in terms of, at that time anyway, not having research budgets and so forth.
No, of course there was Messel that came across early and made a lot of noise at Sydney University. And he was a good entrepreneur, got a lot of funds from the local businessman early in the game.
But that was in the 50s when he came.
Yes, I suppose that was the 50s. Yeah, we're really talking about the period between 46 and 50, aren't we?
Well, in the beginning, yeah.
Yes. Right. I suppose Pawsey was, perhaps without Pawsey, things.